needs people like him. It needs somebody to throw baseballs at, to fag bash, to nigger stomp, to invade, to embargo, anything that, like baseball, keeps a country that's constantly preening in the mirror from actually looking in the mirror and remembering where the bodies are buried. That night, the Dodgers lost their third straight. Hominy sat up in his seat and rubbed a porthole into the suddenly fogged-up windshield. "We home yet?" he asked. We were midway between the El Segundo and Rosecrans Avenue off-ramps, and it hit me. There used to be a sign that read, "Dickens, next exit." Hominy missed the good old days. I missed my father driving us back from the Pomona State Fair, elbowing me awake. The Dodger postgame on the radio as I rubbed the sleep from my eyes just in time to see that sign, "Dickens, next exit," and know I was home. Shit. I miss that sign. And what are cities really besides signs and arbitrary boundaries? The green and white placard didn't cost much. A sheet of aluminum the size of a queen-size bed, 2 6-foot metal poles, some traffic cones and flares, 2 reflective orange vests, 2 cans of spray paint, a couple of hard hats, and that night's sleep. Thanks to a downloaded copy of the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, I had the design specifications for everything from the proper shade of green, Pantone 342, to the exact dimensions, 60 by 36, letter size, 8 inches, and font, Highway Gothic. And after a long night of painting, cutting down the post to size, and stenciling Sunshine Sammy Construction to the doors of the truck in removable paint, Hominy and I set back toward the freeway. Other than pouring and waiting for the cement foundation to dry, installing a traffic control device isn't all that different from planting a tree. And in the light of the high beams, I set to work. Cleared the ivy, dug the holes, and planted the sign, while Hominy passed out in the front seat listening to jazz on KLON. As the sun rose over the El Segundo Boulevard overpass, the morning commute was starting in earnest. And amid the car honking, the rotors of the traffic helicopters beating overhead, and the grinding of truck gears, Hominy and I sat in the breakdown lane, appreciating what we'd done. The sign was a dead ringer for any of the other traffic control devices one sees during the daily commute. It'd taken only a few hours, but I felt like Michelangelo staring at the Sistine Chapel after 4 years of hard labor. Like Banksy, after spending 6 days searching the internet for ideas to steal and 3 minutes of sidewalk vandalism to execute them. "Massa, signs are powerful things. It almost feels like Dickens exists out there in the smog somewhere." "Hominy, what feels better, getting whipped or looking at that sign?" Hominy thought a moment. "The whip feels good on the back, but the sign feels good in the heart." When we arrived home that morning, I popped open a kitchen table beer, sent Hominy home, grabbed the latest edition of the Thomas Guide from the bookshelf. At 4,084 square miles, much of Los Angeles County, like the ocean floor, remains in large part unexplored. Even though you needed an advanced degree in geomatics to understand its 800-plus pages, the Thomas Guide to Los Angeles County is the spiral-bound Sacagawea for any intrepid explorer trying to navigate this urban oasis-less sprawl. Even in the days of GPS devices and search engines, it sits on the front seat of every taxicab, tow truck, and company car, and no Sureño worth their rolling California stop would ever be caught dead without one. I flipped the book open. Every year, my father used to bring the new Thomas Guide home, and the first thing I'd do was turn to pages 704 through 5 and approximate the location of the crib, 205 Bernard Avenue, on the map. Finding my house in that giant tome grounded me somehow, made me feel loved by the world. But 205 Bernard Avenue sat on a nameless peach-colored section of gridiron streets bordered by freeways on each side. I wanted to cry. It hurt knowing that Dickens had been exiled to the netherworld of invisible L.A. communities. top-secret minority bastions like the Dons and the Avenues that have never had or needed Thomas Guide listings, official boundaries, or cheesy billboards announcing, you are now entering or you are now leaving. Because when the voice inside your head, the one you swear up and down isn't prejudice or racism, tells you to roll up the windows and lock the doors, you know you've entered the jungle or fruit town, and that when you start breathing again, you've exited. I dug up a blue marker, drew a crooked outline of my hometown as best as I could remember it, and scribbled Dickens in big Dodger blue letters across pages 704 through 5, and a little pictogram of the exit sign I'd just put up. If I ever raise the nerve, one day I'm going to erect two more signs. So if you find yourself hurtling southbound on the 110 freeway, speeding past two yellow and black blurs that read, watch out for falling home prices, and caution, black-on-black crime ahead, you'll know whom to thank for the roadside warnings. The Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals. Chapter 7. The Sunday after installing the roadside sign, I wanted to make a formal announcement of my plan to reanimate the city of Dickens. And what better place to do so than the next meeting of the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals, the closest approximation we had to a representative government? One of the many sad ironies of African-American life is that every banal, dysfunctional social gathering is called a function. And black functions never start on time, so it's impossible to gauge how to arrive fashionably late without taking a chance of missing the event altogether. Not wanting to have to sit through the reading of the minutes, I waited until the Raiders game reached halftime. Since my father's death, the Dum Dum Donut Intellectuals had devolved into a group of star-struck middle-class black out-of-towners and academics who met bi-monthly to fawn over the semi-famous Foy Cheshire. As much as black America treasures its fallen heroes, it was hard to tell if they were more impressed with his resiliency or that despite all he'd been through, he still drove a vintage 1956 Mercedes 300 SL. Nevertheless, they hovered around, hoping to impress him with their insight into an indigent black community that, if they'd just taken their racial blinders off for one second, they'd realize was no longer black, but predominantly Latino. The meetings consisted mostly of the members who showed up every other week, arguing with the ones who came every other month about what exactly bi-monthly means. I entered the donut shop just as the last copies of The Ticker, an update of statistics related to Dickens, were being passed around. Standing in the back near the blueberry fritters, I held the handout to my nose and inhaled the sweet smell of fresh mimeograph ink before giving it a cursory glance. The Ticker was a societal measure my father had designed to look like a Dow Jones stock report, except that commodities and blue chips were replaced with social ills and pitfalls. Everything that was always up, unemployment, poverty, lawlessness, infant mortality, was up. Everything that's always down, graduation rates, literacy, life expectancy, was even further down. Foy Cheshire stood underneath the clock. In 10 years' time, other than gaining 75 pounds, he hadn't changed much. He wasn't much younger than Hominy, but he'd never grayed, and his face bore only a few laugh lines. On the wall behind him were two framed poster-sized photos, one of a variety box of insanely puffy and succulent-looking donuts that looked nothing like the shriveled-up, lumpy so-called fresh pastries hardening before my eyes in the display case behind me, the other, a color portrait of Pops, proudly wearing his APA tie clasp, his hair shaped to billowy perfection. I played the back. Judging from the serious mood in the room, there was a lot on the agenda. And it'd be a while before the dum-dums got to ancillary business. Foy held two books, fanning them out in front of the group like a magician about to do a card trick. Pick a culture, any culture. He held one aloft, addressing his audience in an affected Southern Methodist drawl, even though he was from the Hollywood Hills by way of Grand Rapids. One night, not long ago, Foy said, I tried to read this book, Huckleberry Finn, to my grandchildren. But I couldn't get past page 6 because the book was fraught with the N-word. And although they are the deepest thinking, combat-ready 8- and 10-year-olds I know, I knew my babies weren't ready to comprehend Huckleberry Finn on its own merits. That's why I took the liberty to rewrite Mark Twain's masterpiece. Where the repugnant N-word occurs, I replaced it with warrior. And the word slave with dark-skinned volunteer.
That's right,
shouted the crowd. I also improved Jim's diction, rejiggered the plot line a bit, and retitled the book The Pejorative Free Adventures and Intellectual and Spiritual Journeys of African-American Jim and His Young Protege, White Brother Huckleberry Finn, as they go in search of the lost black family unit. Then Foy held up the copy of his revamped volume for examination. My eyesight isn't the best, but I could have sworn the cover featured Huckleberry Finn piloting the raft down the mighty Mississippi, while Captain African-American Jim stood at the helm, hands on narrow hips, sporting a cheesy goatee and a tartan Burberry sport coat exactly like the one Foy happened to be wearing. I never much liked going to the meetings, but after my father died, unless there was an emergency on the farm, I showed up. Before Foy's appointment as lead thinker, there had been some talk of grooming me to step in as leader of the group. The Kim Jong-un of ghetto conceptualism. After all, I'd taken over the nigger whispering duties, but I refused. Begging out by claiming I didn't know enough about black culture, that the only certainties I had about the African-American condition were that we had no concept of the phrases too sweet and too salty. And in 10 years, through countless California cruelties and slights against the blacks, the poor, the people of color, like Propositions 8 and 187, the disappearance of social welfare, David Cronenberg's crash, and Dave Eggers's do-gooder condescension, I hadn't spoken a single word. During roll call, Foy never called me by my proper name, but simply yelled, "The sellout!" Looked me in the face with a sly and perfunctory smile, said, "Here!" and placed a check mark next to my name. Foy touched his fingertips together in front of his chest, the universal sign that the smartest person in the room is about to say something. He spoke loudly and quickly, his speech picking up in speed and intensity with every word. I propose that we move to demand the inclusion of my politically respectful edition of Huckleberry Finn into every middle school reading curriculum, he said, because it's a crime that generations of black folk come of age never having experienced this. Foy snuck a peek at the original book's back cover, this hilariously picturesque American classic. Is it black folk or black folks? My having not spoken for the first time in years caught both of us off guard. But I came with the intention of saying something, so why not warm up the vocal cords? I took a bite out of the batch of Oreo cookies I'd boldly snuck in. Which one is grammatically correct? I never know. Foy took a calming sip of cappuccino and ignored me. He and the rest of the non-Dickensian flock belonged to that scary subset of black lycanthropic thinkers I like to refer to as were-niggers. By day, were-niggers are erudite and urbane, but with every lunar cycle, fiscal quarter, and tenure review, their hackles rise, and they slip into their floor-length fur coats and mink stoles, grow fangs, and schlep down from their ivory towers and corporate boardrooms to prowl the inner cities, so that they can howl at the full moon over drinks and mediocre blues music. Now that his fame, if not his fortune, has waned, were-nigger Foy Cheshire's foggy ghetto moor of choice is Dickens. Normally I try to avoid were-niggers at all costs. It's not the fear of being intellectually ripped to shreds that frightens me most. It's the cloying insistence on addressing everyone, especially people they can't stand, as brother so-and-so and sister this and that. I used to bring Harmony to the meetings to alleviate the boredom. Plus, he'd say the shit I was thinking. Why you niggas talk so black, dropping the G's and your gerunds in here? But on your little public television appearances, you motherfuckers sound like Kelsey Grammer with a stick up his ass. But once he heard the widespread rumor that Ford Cheshire had used some of the millions in the royalties he'd earned over the years to purchase the rights to the most racist shorts in the R-Gang oeuvre, I had to ask Harmony to stop coming. He'd scream and stomp, interrupt every motion with some histrionics. Nigger, where are my little rascal movies? Harmony swears his best work is on those reels. If the talk were true, it'd be impossible to forgive that self-righteous guardian of blackness for forever depriving the world of the best in American racial prejudice in Blu-ray and Dolby surround sound. But most everyone knows that, like alligators in the sewers, the lethality of Pop Rocks and soda, for Cheshire's ownership of the most racist Little Rascal films is nothing more than urban legend. Always fast on his feet, Foy countered my insolence and Oreos with a bag of gourmet cannoli. We were both too good to eat the crap dum-dum donuts served up. This is serious. Brother Mark Twain uses the N-word 219 times. That's 0.68 N-words per page in total. If you ask me, Mark Twain didn't use the word nigger enough, I mumbled, with my mouth filled with at least four of America's favorite cookies. I don't think anyone understood me. I wanted to say more. Like, why blame Mark Twain because you don't have the patience and courage to explain to your children that the N-word exists, and that during the course of their sheltered little lives, they may one day be called a nigger, or even worse, deign to call somebody else a nigger? No one will ever refer to them as little black euphemisms, so welcome to the American lexicon, nigger. But I'd forgotten to order any milk to wash the cookies down with, and I never got the chance to explain to Foy and his close-minded ilk that Mark Twain's truth is that your average black nigger is morally and intellectually superior to the average white nigger. But no, those pompous dum-dum niggers wanted to ban the word, disinvent the watermelon, snorting in the morning, washing your dick in the sink, and the eternal shame of having pubic hair the color and texture of unground pepper. That's the difference between most oppressed peoples of the world and American blacks. They vow never to forget, and we want everything expunged from our record, sealed and filed away for eternity. We want someone like Foy Cheshire to present our case to the world with a set of instructions that the jury will disregard centuries of ridicule and stereotype and pretend the woebegone niggers in front of you are starting from scratch. Foy continued his sales pitch. The N-word is the most vile and despicable word in the English language. I don't believe anyone would argue that point. I can think of a more despicable word than nigger, I volunteered. Having finally swallowed my gooey chocolate and cream chaw, I closed one eye and held a half-bitten cookie so that the dark brown semicircle sat atop Foy's gigantic head, like a well-coiffed Nabisco afro that read Oreo at its center. Like what? Like any word that ends in S. Negress, Jewess, poetess, actress, adulteress, fact-checktress. I'd rather be called nigger than giantess any day of the week. Problematic, someone muttered, invoking the code word black thinkers use to characterize anything or anybody that makes them feel uncomfortable, impotent, and painfully aware that they don't have the answers to questions and assholes like me. What the fuck you come here for if you don't have anything productive to say? Foy raised his hands, asking for calm. The dumb-dumb donut intellectuals respect all input. And for those who don't know, this sellout is the son of our founder. Then he turned to me with a look of pity on his face. Go on, sellout. Say what you came to say. Most times when someone presents before the dum-dums, you're required to use EmpowerPoint, a slide presentation African-American software package developed by Foy Cheshire. Not much different from the Microsoft product, except that the fonts have names like Timbuktu, Harlem Renaissance, and Pittsburgh Courier. I open the store's broom closet. Next to the mops and buckets, the old transparency projector was still there, its glass top and lone sheet of transparency paper filthy as prison windows, but still usable. I asked the assistant manager to dim the lights, then drew up and projected the following schematic onto the cork ceiling. A large rectangle. On the left side, outside of the rectangle, no matter how many times referred to as the hood, not the hood. Inside, the hood. At the top, outside, white America. Inside, Dickens. On the right, outside, question mark. Inside, El Vario. On the bottom, outside, the best of times. Inside, the worst of times. I explained that the boundary labels were to be spray-painted onto the sidewalks, and that the lines of demarcation would be denoted by a configuration of mirrors and high-powered green pinpoint lasers, or if that proved to be cost-prohibitive, I could simply circumnavigate the 12 miles of border with a 3-inch strip of white paint. Hearing the words circumnavigate and lines of demarcation come out of my mouth made me realize that, even though I was making this shit up on the spot, I was more serious about this than I thought I was. And yes, I'm bringing back the city of Dickens. Laughter. Waves and peals of deep black laughter, of the kind-hearted plantation owners long for in movies like Gone with the Wind. Laughter like you hear in basketball locker rooms, backstage at rap concerts, and in the back rooms of Yale University's all-white department of black studies after some fuzzy-hair-brained guest lecturer has dared to suggest that there's a connection between Franz Fanon, existential thought, string theory, and bebop. When the chorus of ridicule finally died down, Foy wiped away the tears of hilarity from his eyes, finished the last of the cannoli, scooted in behind me, and turned my father's photo toward the wall, thus saving Pops the embarrassment of having to witness his son desecrate the family intellect. "You say you were going to bring back Dickens?" Foy asked, breaking the question-and-answer ice. "Yes. We, and I think I speak for most of the group, have only one question. Why?" Hurt that I expected everyone to care and no one did, I returned to my seat and spaced out after that. Half listening to the usual diatribes about the dissolution of the black family and the need for black business, waiting for Foy to say, "and things of that nature," which is the Roger over and out of black intellectual communication. "And things of that nature." Finally, the meeting was over, and as the gathering broke up, I was twisting open my last Oreo cookie when, from out of nowhere, a calloused black hand ganked it and popped it into a tight-lipped mouth. "You bring enough for the whole race, nigger." With tufts of perm-straightened hair fastened to hot pink rollers stuffed underneath the see-through shower cap and giant hoop earrings dangling from both ears, the cookie snatcher looked more like a Blanche or a Madge than the notorious gangbanger known as King, pronounced Kang, Cuz. And silently, very silently, I cursed Cuz as he slid his tongue over his metal-rimmed teeth, clearing tiny flecks of chocolatey goodness from his bridge work. "That's what my teachers used to say to me if I was chewing gum and shit. You bring enough for the whole class." "No doubt, nigger." In all the time I've known Cuz, I've never had a real conversation with him beyond "no doubt, nigger." No one has. Because even in his middle age, he's sensitive. And if you say the wrong thing, he'll show the world just how sensitive he is by crying at your funeral. So no one engages him in conversation. Whenever he speaks to you, no matter what he says, man, woman, or child, you put as much bass in your voice as you possibly can and reply, "No doubt, nigger." Kang Cuz has faithfully attended meetings of the Dum Dum Donut intellectuals ever since my father nigger-whispered his mother off of the metro train tracks. Feet and hands bound in a jump rope, She had pitched herself onto the commuter rail, screaming,
"When a white bitch got problems, she's a damsel in distress. When a black bitch got problems, she's a welfare cheat and a burden on society. How come you never see any black damsels?"
"Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your weave."
She was yelling so loud you could hear her suicidal protest over the ding-dong of the falling crossing gate and the blaring horn of the onrushing blue line. Kang Kuz was Curtis Baxter then, and I remember the windy wake of the passing train blowing young Curtis's tears sideways on his face as my dad cradled his mother in his arms. I remember the railroad tracks, rusty and ringing and still hot to the touch. "So you bring enough for the whole race?" Curtis grew up to become Kang Kuz, a gangster well-respected for his brain and his daring do. His set, the Rollin' Paper Chasers, was the first gang to have trained medics at their rumbles. A shootout would pop off at the swap meet, and the stretcher-bearers would cart off the wounded to be treated in some field hospital set up behind the front lines. You didn't know whether to be sad or impressed. It wasn't long after that innovation that he applied for membership to NATO. "Everybody else is in NATO. Why not the Crips? You gonna tell me we wouldn't kick the shit out of Estonia?"
"No doubt, nigger. I need to talk to you about a couple of things."
"No doubt, nigger.
But not in here."
Cuz lifted me by the shirt sleeve and escorted me out the door and into the hazy Hound of the Baskervilles night. It's always a shock to have the day turn to dark without you. And we both paused to let the warm, wet mist and the silence settle on our faces. Sometimes it's hard to tell what's more interminable, prejudice and discrimination, or the goddamn meetings. Cuz made half a fist, examined his long, manicured nails, then raised one heavily teased eyebrow and smiled. "First thing is bringing back Dickens. Fuck what the rest of them niggas who ain't from the hood say. I'm thoroughly with that shit. It ain't but a couple of us in there, but the dum-dums who from Dickens wasn't laughing. So set that off, cuz. Because if you think about it, why can't black people have their own Chinese restaurants?"
"No doubt, nigga."
Then I did something I never thought I'd do. I engaged Kang Kuz in conversation because I had to know, even if it cost me my life or, at the very least, what little cachet I had as the neighborhood's resident quiet motherfucker. "I have to ask you something, Kang Kuz."
"Call me Kuz, Kuz."
"All right, Kuz. Why do you go to these meetings? Shouldn't you be out slanging and banging?"
"It used to be I'd go to listen to your father. Rest in peace, that nigga ran deep, for real. But now, I go just in case these dumb-dumb niggas get the notion to actually set foot in the hood, blowing the spot up and all. That way, I can at least give the homies some Paul Revere-like advance notice. One if by Land Cruiser, two if by C-Class Mercedes. The bougies are coming. The bougies are coming."
"Who's coming where?" It was Foy. Meeting over, he and the other ware niggers were piling into their cars, making ready for a prowl on the town. Curtis Kang Kuz Baxter didn't bother to answer Foy. He simply spun on his Converse heels and pimp walked into the blurry night. Listing hard to the right like a drunken seaman with an inner ear infection, he shouted back at me, "Think about them black Chinese restaurants and get some pussy. You're too damn high-strung."
"Don't listen to that man. Pussy is overrated."
As I unhitched and mounted my horse, Foy thumbed open two bottles of prescription pills and spilled three white tablets into his hand.
.001,
he said, jiggling the tablets in his palm to make sure I'd see them,
Zoloft and Lexapro. What the dosage?
No. My fucking Nielsen ratings. Your dad used to think I was bipolar, but what I really am is by myself. Sounds like you are, too.
He pretended to offer me the pills before placing them gently on his tongue and washing them down with a swig from an expensive-looking silver flask. Since his cartoons had stopped airing, Foy had had a series of morning talk shows, each successive failure slotted at a time earlier and earlier in the morning. Just as Bloods don't use the letter C because it's the first letter in Crip, Cap'n Crunch Cereal with a C is Cap'n Crunch Cereal with a K. Foy shows his gang affiliation by replacing the word fact with black. And he has interviewed everyone from world leaders to dying musicians on programs titled Black in Fiction, Black Totem. His latest installment was a nonsensical race forum on public access called Just the Blacks, Ma'am. It aired at 5 o'clock Sunday mornings. Ain't but two niggas in the world awake at 5 o'clock, and that's Foy Cheshire and his makeup artist. It's hard to describe a man wearing probably close to $5,000 in a suit, shoes, and accessories as disheveled, but up close in the streetlight, that's exactly what he was. All spit and no polish. His shirt wrinkled and losing its starch. The bottoms of his barely creased silk pants ringed brown with dirt and just starting to fray. His shoes were scuffed, and he reeked of creme de menthe. I once heard Mike Tyson say, "Only in America can you be bankrupt and live in a mansion." Foy recapped his flask and jammed it into his pocket. Now that no one was looking, I waited for him to make the full were-nigger transformation, grow fangs and claws. I wondered if the hair on black werewolves was snappy. It had to be, right? I know what you're up to.
What am I up to?
You're about the same age your father was when he died. And you ain't said shit in a meeting for 10 years. Why choose today to talk this nonsense about bringing Dickens back? Because you're trying to reclaim the dum-dums. Take back what your father started.
I don't think so. Any organization that holds lectures about the dangers of diabetes in a donut shop, you can keep.
Maybe I should have seen it then. My father had a checklist to determine whether or not someone was losing his mind. He said there were telltale signs of a mental breakdown that people often mistake for force of personality. Aloofness, mood swings, delusions of grandeur. Apart from Hominy, who, like one of those giant redwood slices you see at the Science Museum, was an open book, I only know how to tell if a tree is dying on the inside, not a person. The tree sort of withdraws into itself. The leaves become splotchy. Sometimes there are cankers and fissures in the bark. The branches might be bone dry or soft and spongy to the touch. But the best way is to look at the roots. The roots are what anchors a tree to the ground, holds it in place on this spinning ball of shit. And if those are cracked and covered in spores and fungi, well, I remember looking at Foy's roots. A pair of expensive brown wingtips. They were scuffed and dusty. So given the rumors about his wife filing for divorce, the bankruptcy, and his talk show's non-existent ratings, maybe I should have known.
"I've got my eye on you," he said, sliding into his car. "The dum-dum donuts is all I have left. I will not let you fuck my shit up."
Two goodbye beeps of his horn, and he was gone, swooping his Benz down El Cielo Boulevard, reaching mock speed as he flew past Cuz, whose slow-footed strut was unmistakable even from a distance. It doesn't happen often, but once in a crisp blue moon, a member of the dum-dum donut intellectual says something ingenious like black Chinese restaurants and pussy.
"No doubt, nigger," I said aloud, and for the first time, I meant it.
Chapter 8 I went with the painted boundary. Not that the lasers cost so much, though the pointers that had the intensity I needed were a few $100 apiece. It's that I found the painting to be meditative. I've always liked Rode. The formulaic repetitiveness of filling and stuffing envelopes appeals to me in some fundamental life-affirming way. I would have made a good factory worker, supply room clerk, or Hollywood scriptwriter. In school, whenever I had to do something like memorize the periodic table, my father would say the key to doing boring tasks is to think about not so much what you're doing, but the importance of why you're doing it. Though when I asked him if slavery wouldn't have been less psychologically damaging if they'd thought of it as gardening, I got a vicious beating that would have made Kuta Kinte wince. I bought a shitload of white spray paint and a line marking machine, the kind used to paint yardage markers and foul lines on ball fields, and before my morning chores, when the traffic was light, I'd haul my ass to the designated location, set up shop in the middle of the road, and paint the line. Paying no attention to the line's straightness or my attire, I laid down the border. It was a sign of the ineffectualness of the Dum Dum Donut think tank that no one had any idea what I was doing. Most folks who didn't know me mistook me for a performance artist or a crazy person. I was cool with the latter designation. But after a few thousand yards of squiggly white lines, it became obvious to any Dickensian over the age of 10 what I was doing. Unsolicited, groups of truant teens and homeless would stand guard over the line, plucking leaves and debris out of the wet paint, shooing away bicyclists and jaywalkers to prevent them from smearing the border. Sometimes, after retiring for the day, I'd return the next morning, only to find that someone else had taken up where I'd left off, extended my line with a line of their own, often in a different color. Sometimes the line wouldn't be a line at all, but drops of blood or an uninterrupted string of graffiti signing off on my efforts. Ace Boone, a.k.a. the West Side Crazy 63rd Street Gangster, or as in the case of the corner fronting the L.A. LGBTDL Crisis Center for Chicanos, blacks, non-gays, and anyone else who feels underserved, unsupported, and exploited by hit cable television shows, an arcing, 3-foot-wide, 400-foot-long rainbow anchored with pots of gold condoms. Halfway down Victoria Boulevard, where the L. Harvard Bridge starts to cross the creek, someone bisected my line with 100 smoots in purple print. I still have no idea what that means, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that with all the help, it didn't take long to finish painting the border. The police, many of whom knew me through my work and my watermelon, often escorted me from their patrol cars, checking my boundary for accuracy against old editions of the Thomas Guide. I didn't mind Officer Mendez's good-natured teasing.
What are you doing?
I'm looking for the lost city of Dickens.
By painting a white line down the middle of a street that already has two yellow lines down the middle of it?
You love the mangy dog that shows up in your backyard as much as the puppy you got for your birthday.
Then you should put up a flyer, she said, handing me a mock-up she'd hurriedly composed on the back of a wanted poster.
Missing. Hometown. Have you seen my city? Description. Mostly black and brown. Some Samoan. Friendly. Answers to the name of Dickens. Reward earned in heaven. If you have any information, please call this number. 1-800-DICKENS. I appreciated the help, and using a wad of chewed gum, fastened the flyer to the nearest telephone post. For those looking to find the thing that you've lost, the decision of where to place your handbill is one of the toughest you'll ever make in life. I chose a space at the bottom of the pole, between a circular for an Uncle Jam's Army concert at the Veterans Center. Uncle Jam wants you to serve and funk in Los Afghanistan, California. A la Ak Open Bar from 9 to 10 p.m. And a leaflet promoting a mysterious dream job that paid $1,000 a week, working from home.
I hoped whoever posted that flyer had had a talk with human resources, because I seriously doubted they were making even $300 a week, and they definitely weren't working from home. It took about 6 weeks to finish painting the border and the labels, and in the end, I wasn't sure what I'd accomplished. But it was fun to see the kids spend their Saturdays circumnavigating the city by carefully tracing their steps, walking heel to toe on the line, making sure they'd left not even an inch untrod upon. Sometimes I'd chance across an elderly member of the community standing in the middle of the street, unable to cross the single white line. Puzzled looks on their faces from asking themselves why they felt so strongly about the Dickens side of the line as opposed to the other side. When there was just as much uncurbed dog shit over there as here. When the grass, what little of it there was, sure in the fuck wasn't any greener. When the niggers were just as trifling, but for some reason they felt like they belonged on this side. And why was that, when it was just a line? I have to confess that in the days after I painted it, I too was hesitant to cross the line, because the jagged way it surrounded the remnants of the city reminded me of the chalk outline the police had needlessly drawn around my father's body. But I did the line's artifice, the implication of solidarity and community it represented. And while I hadn't quite reestablished Dickens, I had managed to quarantine it, and community come leper colony wasn't a bad start. Exact Change, or Zen and the Art of Bus Riding and Relationship Repair. Chapter 9. Sometimes the smell wakes you up in the middle of the night. Chicago has the hawk, and Dickens, despite its newly painted barrier, has the stank. An eye-burning, colorless miasma of sulfur and shit birthed in the Wilmington oil refineries and the Long Beach sewage treatment plant. Carried inland by the prevailing winds, the stank gathers up a steamy pungency as the fumes combine with the stench of the lounge lizards returning home from partying in Newport Beach, drenched in sweat, tequila shooter runoff, and gallons of over-applied Dracar Noir cologne. They say the stank drops the crime rate by 90%, but when the smell slaps you awake at 3 in the morning, the first thing you want to do is kill Guy LaRoche. It was a night about 2 weeks after I'd painted the border. The stench was especially strong, and I was unable to get back to sleep. I tried cleaning the stables, hoping the smell of fresh horse manure would remove the sting from my nostrils. It didn't work, and I had to resort to covering my face with a dish rag soaked in vinegar to kill the fumes. Hominy walked in with my wetsuit draped over one arm and a bowl in the other hand. He was dressed like a British manservant, complete with coat and tails and a vacillating BBC Masterpiece Theater accent. "What are you doing here?"
"I saw the lights and thought maybe Master would like the black hash and a little fresh air this evening."
"Hominy, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Why aren't you in bed?"
"Same reason you aren't. It smells like a bum's asshole outside."
"Where'd you get the tux?"
"Back in the 50s, every black actor had one. Show up for a casting call for butler or head waiter, and the studio would be like, 'Boy, you just saved us $50. You're hired.'"
A little wake and bake and some surfing wasn't a bad idea. I'd be too high to drive to the beach, but that would give me an excuse to see my girl for the first time in months. Catching some waves and a whiff of my baby, that'd be like killing two birds with one stoner, so to speak. Hominy walked me into the living room, spun Daddy's recliner around, and patted the armrest.
"Sit."
The gas fireplace roared to life, and I stuck a punk into the flames, sparked the bowl, and took a long, smooth pull, and was high before I could exhale. I must have left the back door open, because one of the newborn calves, shiny, black, barely a week old, and not yet used to the sounds and smells of Dickens, wandered in and stared me down with his big brown eyes. I blew a puff of hashish into his face, and together we could feel the stress leave our bodies. As the blackness peeled from our hides, the melanin fizzing and dissipating into nothingness like antacids dissolving in tap water. They say a cigarette takes 3 minutes off your life, but good hashish makes dying seem so far away. The distant staccato of gunfire sounded in the air, the last shootout of the night followed by the beating rotors of the police helicopter. The calf and I split a double of single malt to take the edge off. Harmony pitched himself by the door. A parade of ambulances sped down the street, and he handed me my surfboard like a butler hands an English gentleman his coat. Feigned or not, sometimes I'm jealous of Harmony's obliviousness, because he, unlike America, has turned the page. That's the problem with history. We like to think it's a book, that we can turn the page and move the fuck on, but history isn't the paper it's printed on. It's memory, and memory is time, emotions, and song. History is the things that stay with you.
Master, I just thought you should know. My birthday's next week.
I knew something was up. He was being too attentive. But what do you get the slave who doesn't even want his freedom?
Well, that's cool. We'll take a trip or something. In the meantime, could you do me a favor and put the calf out back?
I don't do farm animals.
Even when the air doesn't smell, when you walk the ghetto streets in a spring suit, board tucked under one arm, no one really fucks with you. Maybe once in a while a curious stick-up kid might take the measure, look me up and down, and make a guess as to how much the pawn shop would give him for the antique town and country trifin. Sometimes they stop me in front of the laundromat, stare in amazement at the homie wearing open-toe flip-flops, and pinch my outer layer of black polyurethane skin.
Check it out, cuz. Sup? Where you keep your keys at?
The 5:43 a.m. number 125 westbound to El Segundo rolled in on time. The pneumatic door swung open with that strong, hissing efficiency that I love, and the driver welcomed me aboard with a friendly, "Hurry up, motherfucker. You letting the stank in." Bus operator number 632 thought we were broken up just because years ago she married that has-been gangster rapper, now semi-famous television cop and malt liquor pitchman, MC Panache. Had 4 kids, and had a restraining order requiring me to stay 500 feet away from her and the children, because I would follow them home from school screaming, "Your daddy doesn't know his assonance from his elegy, and he calls himself a poet." I took my usual seat, the one closest to the stairwell, kicked back, and stretched my feet into the aisle, wielding the board like a fiberglass African shield, deflecting the spinning barrage of polyseed shells and insults as best I could.
"Fuck you! Fuck you!"
Banished and hurt, I scuttled to the back of the bus, deposited my surfboard on the rear seat, and lay down on it like a heartbroken fakir, sleeping on a bed of nails, trying to displace the emotional pain with the physical. The bus lumbered down Rosencrantz. The unrequited love of my life, my pessa, Delissa Dawson, calling out stops like a Buddhist timekeeper, while a crazy man 3 rows in front of me recited the morning mantra.
"I'm gonna fuck that black bitch up. I'm gonna fuck that black bitch up. I'm gonna fuck that black bitch up. I'm going to fuck that black bitch up."
There are more cars in Los Angeles County than in any other city in the world. But what no one ever talks about is that half those cars sit on cinder blocks and dirt patches passing for front yards from Lancaster to Long Beach. These not-so-mobile automobiles, along with the Hollywood sign, the Watts Towers, and Aaron Spelling's 56,500-square-foot estate, are the closest L.A. gets to approximating the ancient marvels of engineering, like the Parthenon, Angkor Wat, the Great Pyramids, and the ancient shrines of Timbuktu. Those 2- and 4-doored rusted pieces of antiquity stand impervious to the winds and acid rains of time, and like Stonehenge, we have no idea what purpose these steel monuments serve. Are they testaments to the bitchin' and firme hot rods and lowriders that grace the covers of custom car magazines? Maybe the hood ornaments and tail fins are aligned with the stars and the winter solstice. Maybe they're mausoleums, the resting places of backseat lovers and drivers. All I know is that each of these metallic carcasses means one less car on the road and one more rider on the bus of shame. Shame because L.A. is about space, and here one's self-worth comes from how one chooses to navigate that space. Walking is akin to begging in the streets. Taxicabs are for foreigners and prostitutes. Bicycles, skateboards, and rollerblades are for health nuts and kids, people with nowhere to go. And all cars, from the luxury import to the classified ad jalopy, are status symbols. Because no matter how shoddy the upholstery, how bouncy the ride, how fucked up the paint job, the car, any car, is better than riding the bus. Alameda, Marpessa shouted, and a woman scurried aboard, toting one too many plastic shopping bags and pinning her purse tightly to her side with her elbow. She made her way down the aisle, scanning for vacancies. I can spot an L.A. newcomer a mile away. They're the ones who board the bus smiling and greeting the other passengers, because they believe, despite all evidence to the contrary, that having to take mass transportation is only a temporary setback. They're the ones sitting under the safe sex ads, looking up quizzically from their Bret Easton Ellis novels, trying to figure out why the assholes surrounding them aren't all white and opulent like the assholes in the book. They're the ones who jump up and down like game show prize winners when they discover that In-N-Out Burger has both a secret menu and a double top-secret menu. Mustard grilled patties? Get the fuck out of here! They sign up for open mics at the Laugh Factory, jog along the boardwalk, trying to convince themselves that the double penetration scene they shot in Reseda last week is only a stepping stone to bigger and better things. La pornographie est la nouvelle vogue. Many parents brag about their kids' first words. Mommy, Daddy, I love you. Stop. No, that's inappropriate. My father, on the other hand, liked to boast about his first words to me. They weren't hello or a prayer, but a sentiment found in the first chapter of every intro to social psych textbook ever written. We are all social scientists. And I suppose my first field research was conducted on the bus. When I was young, the municipal bus system was called the RTD. Officially, the acronym stood for Rapid Transit District. But to Angelenos, who lived in hellholes like Watts, La Puente, and South Central, too young or too poor to drive, it stood for rough, tough, and dangerous. My first scientific paper, written at age 7, was Passenger Seating Tendencies by Race and Gender, Controlling for Class, Age, Crowdedness, and Body Odor. The conclusion was readily obvious. If forced to sit next to someone, people violated the personal space of women first and black people last. If you were a black male, then no one, including other black males, sat next to you unless they absolutely had to. Whereupon they reluctantly plop down next to me and invariably greet me with one of 3 security questions designed to assess my threat level. 1. Where do you live? 2. Did you see, insert sporting event or black-themed movie? 3. I don't know where you from, homie, but you see this knife-slash-gun-slash-contagious skin rash? You don't fuck with me, and I won't fuck with you, cool? I could tell from the way they pulled her arms into the ground that the bags were getting heavy, that she was barely holding on to her groceries and dreams. Even though she was exhausted and growing more and more despondent with each bumpy rise and fall of the worn-out suspension, she preferred to stand rather than to sit next to me. They come to L.A. aspiring to be white. Even the ones who are biologically white aren't white-white. Laguna Beach Volleyball, white.
Belair, white. Amakaze, white. Spicoli, white. Brett Easton Ellis, white. Three first names, white. Valet parking, white. Brag about your Native American, Argentinian, Portuguese ancestry, white. Faux, white. Paparazzi, white. I once got fired from a telemarketing job. Now look at me, I'm famous, white. Calabasas, white. I love L.A. It's the only place where you can go skiing, to the beach, and to the desert all in one day, white. She held on to her vision rather than sit next to me. Not that I blamed her, because by the time the bus hit Figueroa Boulevard, there were a number of people on board whom I wouldn't have chosen to sit next to either. Like the insane fucker who repeatedly pressed the stop requested button.
Stop this bus, goddammit. I want to get off.
Where the fuck you going? Even that early in the day, stopping a bus between designated stops was the same as asking the flight crew of an Apollo rocket to the moon to stop at the liquor store on the way. Impossible.
I said, stop the motherfucking bus! I'm late for work, you fat fucking cow!
Drivers, wardens, and concentration camp commandants all have their own management style. Some like to sing to the passengers, placating them with uplifting jazz age ditties like Tea for Two and My Funny Valentine. Others like to hide, sit low in their seats, and let the inmates run the asylum and the aisles, seatbelts unfastened in case the need for a quick getaway arises. Marpessa was no disciplinarian, but she wasn't a pushover either. Her average workday was filled with fights, purse snatchings, fare beaters, molestations, public intoxication, child endangerment, pandering, niggas constantly standing on the wrong side of the yellow line while the bus was in motion, and kicking game, to say nothing of the occasional attempted murder. Her union rep said a bus driver in this country is assaulted once every 3 days, and there were two things in the world Marpessa had long since decided she'd never be: a statistic and somebody's fat cow. I don't know how she resolved the problem, with a kind word or the threatening wave of the metal nigger beater she kept behind her seat, because I fell asleep and didn't wake up until we reached El Segundo, her call of last stop echoing throughout the empty bus. I know she hoped that I'd exit out the back, but even in that hideous commie gray metro uniform, 30 pounds heavier, she was still unbearably cute. On the freeway, you can't stop looking at a dog sticking its head out of a car window, and I couldn't take my eyes off her.
Close your mouth. You're catching flies. You miss me?
Miss you?
I haven't missed nobody since Mandela died.
Is Mandela dead? Seems like he's gonna live forever.
Well, either way, there you go.
See? You do miss me.
I miss your fucking plums. I swear to God, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming about your fucking plums and the juicy-ass pomegranates. I almost didn't break up with you because I kept thinking, where am I going to get fucking cantaloupes that taste like a multiple orgasm?
We'd rekindled our childhood friendship on the bus. I was 17, carless, and clueless. She was 21, and fine enough to make that ill-fitting seaweed-brown RTD uniform look like haute couture fashion. Except for the badge. No one, not even John Wayne, can pull off a badge. Back then, she drove the number 434 downtown to Zuma Beach, a route that once you got past the Santa Monica Pier was mostly riderless, except for the burnouts, bums, and maids who served the Malibu estates and oceanfront bungalows. I surfed Venice and Santa Monica, mostly Station 24, sometimes 20. No real reason. The waves were shit, crowded, except that every now and then I'd see another surfer of color. As opposed to Hermosa, Redondo, and Newport, which were much closer to Dickens, but the breaks were dominated by straight-edge Jesus freaks who kissed their crucifixes before every set and listened to conservative talk radio after the sessions. Up the coast, along Marpessa's route, it was more laid back. The west side. ACDC, Slayer, and KLOS FM. The Wave Riders crack and hide.